So before I start, I was, as Pastor Don said, I was talking with him about that paper I had written several, I think 2 years ago or so, I'm not sure. And mainly looking into that piece of papers and information about the German science and invention during the time of National Socialist government. It came about when we, about 5-6 years ago, had a student from the Northern Kentucky University who worked as a volunteer at the ARC, and he had to write a paper about the GFCI, the ground failure interrupting breaker, which you use to make sure that you don't get hit when something goes wrong with your equipment. And there are also outlets which work as this. You usually know the outlets. And I went through his paper and I said, well, wait a second. You're writing here that was invented by an American company? That's not true. And he said, oh, yeah, I have a book here. I said, yeah, take that book and throw it in the trash because it's lying. The GFCI was actually first time mentioned and patented in Germany 1923 exactly, I think. And it was revised in 1932. And it's definitely a German invention. So I thought, what is going on here? So I started to dig into some other issues like the transistor, which is officially was officially invented by some people at the Bell Labs, which is not true. Infrared devices, laser scan systems, and things like that. So I started to look for literature. I found a ton of books which are focusing on, first it was focused on that Operation Paperclip, which the United States started in 1944. They called it differently then, I will come to that later. And also more and more books came out or came to my knowledge about the huge extension of German patents and inventions taking from Germany after the end of World War II and just considered American, British, Russian, or French properties. So based on that, I would like to start my presentation with a biblical-based traditional German expression. And in German, that means Unrecht gut gedeiht nicht und kommt nicht auf den dritten Erben. Now, what is this in English? This. It is a combination of two older proverbs, traditions, in the Lutheran Church especially. It's part of Proverbs 10:2, treasuries of the wickedness profit nothing, but righteousness delivers from debt. Does not reach the third heir belongs to a related European, especially Latin medieval proverb tradition. The Latin form is something like, I try to pronounce it. De male quesitis non gaudet tertius heres. I hope that is at least close enough to Latin expression. So it means the third heir scarcely does not enjoy what was badly required. So if we put that all together, illegitimate property does not prosper and does not pass to the third heir. So I have that Latin again. I don't want to butcher it again. What that means is if we look back, the generation who won World War II from the United States perspective, And then we are the next generation, right? And then there are our grandkids or our children, which are now in a position to gain leadership in this nation here. Look in what state the United States is. We are heavily in debt, almost unpayable debt. The society is split off, is the moral is decayed and is on a extreme fast path down to the tube to total. I can't even find words for it. So I think that is a very good indication where the Lord will put those who are not adhered to his word. The whole presentation is the greatest government organized patent and innovation theft of all time. And I will try to prove that statement as far as I can. With the theft of hundreds of thousands of German patents and innovations, the U.S. achieved an absolutely unprecedented coup after the end of World War II. Its effects are still clearly noticeable in the 21st century. In his book, Unternehmen Patentraub 1945, in English translation, Operation Patent Theft 1945, the author Friedrich Georg asks and tries to answer the following questions. Would the United States, despite its overwhelming victory in 1945, have declined to a second-rate technological nation without the intellectual plunder of Germany? Did the U.S. President Truman, aware of the U.S. shortcomings, grant his occupying forces a de facto license to steal all usable German innovations? Was the scientific and technological superiority of the Germans already known in Washington, and had the General Staff therefore begun planning the operation patent theft early on? How did the systematic persecution of Germans' intellectual property, as well as its researchers and engineers, really unfold? Is it true that German inventors who refused to divulge secrets were still threatened with death penalty in 1948? Is the number of patents seized in Berlin in 1945 demonstrably understated? Why was Professor Ferdinand Porsche so important? What secret still lies hidden in the mass importation of top German scientists to the U.S. for their research? How did important future technologies like magnetic tape, computers, television, and transistor technology actually came about? Was Leuna's synthetic gasoline production a cause of the war? Was President Bush's sensational space bomber really so new? Is the value of patents and inventions taken from Germany by the USA so astronomical that nobody in business or politics is allowed to talk about it today? Since we don't have 20 hours or more to look into every question, I will focus on just a few today. Why German patents and developments were so important for the United States. At the end of the 1930s, the system of the free world trade embodied by its leading power, the USA, faced a major challenges from authoritarian, economically successful power blocks. Even more threatening for the defenders of the old order was the fact that they were even in danger of losing. The government of the Third Reich had abandoned the gold standard and introduced the labor currency. To this end, liberal bilateral trade agreements on a clearing basis were concluded with 25 countries around the world. So that's the part where that Jewish declaration of war comes into place, which happened in June 1933, by the Jewish World Congress. What they did was they threatened these 25 countries, actually all countries around the world they had economical connections to, that if they would go into this kind of agreements with Germany, they would just stop the money flow to those countries and would boycott those countries and their products. A pure barter system emerged, with modern German industrial products being exchanged for necessary raw materials and foodstuff. The dollar and pound sterling were largely rendered obsolete, which significantly impacted the Wall Street elites. The German system functioned extremely well, and there was a risk that other countries would adopt this approach. Germany's trade bloc was particularly dangerous because it was complemented by a very successful domestic production of gasoline, diesel, rubber, and textile fibers. A plethora of new patents and inventions further aroused suspicion and envy. Danger also threatened the Western system, as we know it today, from another direction. What would happen if authoritarian economic system succeeded in providing that irrevocable link between liberal democracy and prosperity, still considered valid today, was a mere fluke. As statements by leading American officials prove, the Second World War was also about the fact that the U.S. industrial dominance could not develop in the post-war period without the prior dismantling of the German economic system. And that was actually written in a so-called Kilgore report, which was made for the United States Senate in 1945-46. The chairman of this subcommittee, Mr. Kilgore, correctly noted that after the end of the Second World War, no nation was stronger than their scientific resources was, and that the evidence was obvious that humanity was on the threshold of the time of great possibilities. American science was not at all equipped for this, as was brutally revealed to the Senate. People were horrified to discover that virtually no basic scientific research had been conducted in the United States during the war years, even though the national research budget had increased from a pre-war level of $300 million to over $800 million in 1944. Sounds a little low, right? But you have to take it times 12 to get an idea what it would be today. In late summer 1944, after the Allies, with the help of German traders, had successfully gained a foothold in Western Europe, the American Attorney General Francis Biddle let the cat out of the bag. Biddle told the Senate committee bluntly that should be done with the German economy. These German industrial companies concluded the very contracts we have to deal with. The period between the wars was merely an armistice which German companies used to wage an economic warfare against us. Yeah, that's one way to say it. The government of the Third Reich abandoned the gold standard and introduced... Am I going backward? Okay. Behind the scenes, however, leading economic and military circles in the USA probably knew at the time of this Trump triumph that they had been outrageously lucky. After careful study of the true state of American science, a specially appointed subcommittee of the U.S. Senate Military Committee in 1946 could not share this optimistic opinion regarding either the present state or the future of American science. On the contrary, an objective analysis of the American military science led to some truly disturbing conclusions. It was noted with dismay that practically no basic scientific research had been carried out during the wars, even though the research budget had increased from 300 to 800 million. During the war, U.S. scientists had instead focused solely on finding profitable applications for previously discovered science principles. Even worse was the fact that the scientific discoveries applied by U.S. scientists during the war were mostly made not by Americans, but in Europe. It was sobering to discover that the revolutionary sulfonamides were discovered in Germany research laboratories, atomic fragmentation in Berlin, and that the foundational work for radio and radar was, well as the enormous American electronic industry, was the work of German professors. Penicillin came from England, and even DDT, so often portrayed in propaganda as a purely American invention, came actually from Germany and Switzerland. As an example, Professor Hans Erich Hollmann, and not the English Randall and Boot, was the real inventor of the later so famous multi-chamber magnetron. Hans Erich Hollmann had an earlier German priority Telefunken patent for the magnetron of the multi-cavity or multi-chamber family, well before Randall and Boot's in 1940 Birmingham work. The strongest primary evidence is U.S. patent 2123728 magnetron. It lists Hollmann Hans Erich as the inventor, Telefunken AG as the assignee. A priority date of 1935-1129. U.S. filings 1936-1127. And publication grant on 1938-07-12. This is just one example where it is clearly provable that a invention which was propagandized and trumped to the world as a British invention was actually a German. But a long time after that first shot, after we had gained the upper hand over our enemies with considerable difficulty, we found ourselves in some scientific no man's land. Of course, we won the war, but we have to work on it. Remember that we had a lot of luck on our side. At the end of his lecture, Colonel Watson asked the audience, "Do we want to trust luck again?" And Colonel Donald L. Pert, who was in charge of the exploiting scientific German scientific secrets, expressed it similarly. The Germans were ahead of us in some areas by between 2 and 15 years. It must be said here that the Germans were ahead of us many areas, such as rockets, guided missiles, jet engines, jet aircraft, synthetic fuels, supersonic research. The German developments in these areas are now of the utmost importance to us. They enable us to achieve hitherto unheard of speeds in air transport, to consider later flights high in the stratosphere, and one day even to considering interplanetary travel. Thus, we might ask whether, in possession of this information, we should continue to burden American taxpayers with time and money, or whether, if we are not too proud, we should rather exploit the information generated in Germany. The American industrial apparatus is called upon to begin where the Germans left off and to provide us with the necessary equipment so that we can become the leaders in the scientific world. Where the Germans left off is a very strange wording here, right? The Germans didn't left off in their science research. They were left off. They have been helped to left off in a very nice way. How the patent robbery enterprise was organized. There was an expression, developing ideas is expensive, stealing them is cheap. Andrew Govers, the head of the communications and marketing of Lehman Brothers. Sounds familiar. Anyway. As early as May 14, 1945, the Joint Secretary of State, GSC, had written to the State Department that the knowledge gained from previous investigations should now be distributed to the American business and industry. What was lacking, however, was official White House approval for these commercial exploitation activities involving German intellectual capital. Executive Order 9604. It is the policy of this government, subject to the requirements of national military security, that there shall be prompt, public, free, and general dissemination of enemy scientific and industrial information. The expression enemy scientific and industrial information, as used herein, is defined to comprise all information concerning scientific, industrial, and technological processes, inventions, methods, devices, improvements, advances heretofore or hereafter obtained by any department or agency of this government in enemy countries, regardless of their origin, or in liberated areas if such information is of enemy origin or has been acquired or appropriated by the enemy. It was nothing less than a commercialized robbery of technology without limits, because Truman defined the term scientific and industrial information as all information encompassing scientific, industrial, and technological processes, invention, methods, devices, improvements, and advances captured by U.S. agents and in enemy countries before or after the issuance of Executive Order 9604, regardless of where that technology was originated. Sort, divide, and destroy. Because of the enormous amount of papers, I mean, we are talking about tons and tons, thousands of tons of papers, over 738,000 patents alone, which have been confiscated. The activities to organize those papers and to sort them out and get a comprehensive understanding what the Allies had in their hands, they concluded a conference, the Frankfurt Document Conference, and it deserves a closer examination. Much of what happened then is still influences today how we see the world. From October 22nd to 25th, 1945, the German Documents Conference took place at the headquarters of the American Armed Forces in Europe. All civilian and military authorities involved in occupying of Germany participated. It's a facsimile of the decisive text in which was the protocol of that document conference, and one of the most important part was to decide which of the documents will deny it to the Germans for all time, forever. They excluded several hundred thousand pieces of paper to be accessed by Germans at this time and forever. It is not clear today if those papers were just archived and access is denied, or if they have actually been destroyed. So this is the general record of the document conference in Frankfurt, where they also decided that certain papers are not good for the Germans because that are German papers and we don't want to have them to see them. And I will read it to you because I think it's too small. I couldn't make it larger because then it wouldn't fit in that size. At the time of the meeting, there were 1,600 tons of documents awaiting disposition of member agencies. Document Central section should request each of the document centers and accumulation points to submit a report on general nature, the bulk and digested disposition of collections held by them. This will not apply to collections at FLAT and IG Farm Central, whose collections are not of general interest. Document control section should determine the disposition of documents accumulation held at various points. Every effort should be made to expedite the transmittal of target reports from Army to U.S. forces, from Army or U.S. forces, Austria document centers to the DCS and the interested agencies to enable more rapid disposition of documents in targets. So this is an instruction how to handle those more than 1,600 tons of paper.
They exempted the IG Farben papers.
You know why?
They didn't want the truth out.
That's correct. I have some more examples for IG Farben. But what mainly the point was, IG Farben was the owner of the patents for the hydrogenation of coal, producing diesel, benzene, gasoline, all kind of chemical products out of coal. They didn't want that to become public because it was a huge danger for the oil industry, which the United States at this time was almost completely in control of by British. We must recognize at all times of the final deposal of documents required for study in Germany, which must not be permitted to fall into German hands after the departure of the occupation forces. It was then coordinated with the armed forces on documents which should be destroyed and to which the Germans were to be denied all future access. This is in that paper here, which I put a facsimile on, because if you download that PDF, you can increase it and then you can read it for yourself. It's not fake, it's real. All of this shows that it is difficult to cope with the enormous quantities of captured documents, 1,600 tons in the document centers alone. And that's not all of it. That was just what they had already at this point in fall of 1945 in their document centers. The whole collection or robbery went on till late in 1947. So a total of 2 years, they were like locust swarms running over Germany. The systematically destroying or taking away documents that could be harmful to the Allies and useful to Germany. It appears that a large number of such documents were denied to the Germans in order to maintain the post-war view of things desired by the Allies to this day. Holocaust? Anybody? This is a clear in the published documents for the documented conference in Frankfurt am Main held. Apparently, people are still afraid to admit the truth to this day. Now, I have to add here that the authors have every single statement they have, and I think the book is somewhere. Yes. So this is the book, so that you can see, right? Unfortunately, it's only in German. I have not found out yet if they are translated in English. But every statement they do, they have sources there where they have that from. Oh, you can see that there are sources listed. And you can look at that book after if you want. So yeah, it is an enormous amount of documents that have been transported away. Last time I talked about the betrayal of the Germans by their own people during the war, and that the third tank army under Patton was suddenly moving from their normal. So they were, as you remember, they were the main force to crash the Ardennes offensive of the German, the last offensive the Germans had started. And the Third Army was moved over from the southern front lines to crash and help to crash the Ardennes offensive. And after that, everybody thought, and even Patton thought, they would move on towards the Rhine area and conquer the industrial heart of Germany, because they were just in full move. But suddenly they got ordered to turn south again, southeast, and Patton's Third Tank Army moved into the area, partly Austria, partly today Czechoslovakia, and the southern area of that was Middle Germany, Thuringia, and this part of the area, which was actually determined to be the Soviet occupation zone. But they moved in there. Why? I mean, strange, right? No, it's not strange, because they took about 1,100 truckloads of equipment and paperwork out of the underground manufacturing places in those areas in Thuringia. 1,100 truckloads. That's not included in the 1,600 or 1,600 tons here. As I said, we don't have the time to get to all of it. That's not included in my presentation here. All of this shows that it is difficult to cope. From now on, no one can deny that there was an operation organized by conference to destroy and refuse documents that could be politically and economically useful for Germany's post-war period. The League of Seas contained following organizations, and that's just a few of the major organizations. BIOS, British Intelligence Objective Subcommittee, was the British counterpart to FIAT. Numerous BIOS reports still serve today to document German high technology during the Second World War. One of those reports actually confirmed that the transistor technology was almost completed in Germany before the war ended. FIAT is the Field Intelligence Agency Technical, was a special American instrument for acquiring German knowledge in the field of industrial research. Headquartered in Frankfurt, the collectors and hunters were a department of the TUB. FIAT was partial, I think I have that TUB somewhere. The FIAT was partially notorious and hated by the Germans. Belgians and Dutch also undertook industrial espionage commissioned by, in German, using FIAT identification cards. So after the war was over and that FIAT was founded, Belgian and Dutch forces used FIAT identification cards and systems to went after German inventions. Like, hey, we belong to this group. The TUB, Technical Industrial Intelligence Branch, was later renamed TOC, Technical Industrial Intelligence Committee. Initially an agency of the American Joint Chief of Staff, the TUB was incorporated into the American Department of Commerce in January 1946, reflecting its importance. His task was to critically examine all areas of the German industrial landscape and to secure any information that could be advantageous to the American economic interests. During 1946, the TUB TOC sent over 400 so-called investigators to Germany. Many of these industrial experts worked at the expense of their own companies and were sworn in as a temporary government employee. The OSS, Office of Strategic Reserves, today CIA, I don't have to say more about that, right? Everybody knows that satanic organization. Then the EEIS, Enemy Equipment Investigation Service, secured German weapons and military equipment such as aircraft, tanks, binoculars, ammunition, metalworking equipment to ensure their testing and the instruction of Allied personnel. Also's mission searched for atomic bomb in Germany and suitable detonators. Also's also had counter propaganda tasks which have now been forgotten. CIOS, Combined Intelligence Objectives Subcommittee, was established in August 21, 1944, by the Joint Anglo-American General Staff. It was intended to ensure military-civilian cooperation among the most important economic, military, and political bodies of the countries for their mutual benefit. The word exploitation appears for the first time as an operational term at the CIOS. Translated, this means exploitation or sucking dry, and accurately describes what was meant. Naval Technical Mission Europe, originally part of the ALSOS mission, soon developed a life of its own, as it focused not only on naval and air force facilities, but also on German industrial advancements, such as synthetic fuels and lubricants that could be of interest to the American Navy. The shipping ports used were Bremen, Bremerhaven, Naples, Genoa, Rotterdam, Antwerp, Le Havre, Cherbourg, and Marseille. By November 1945, U.S. naval personnel had already shipped 9,400 tons of captured technology to the United States, including 350 tons from a mine in Luxembourg. In Ludwigshafen, the entire factory was dismantled and loaded onto ships. Ludwigshafen was the main production plant of IG Farben. The whole factory was dismantled. Just, I think I have that image in the, I can't remember, but there's an image in the book of that factory, and you get an idea how large it was. And all this was just the beginning of a gold rush in foreign property acquisition. Why is that activation? Stupid. Since the Reich Patents Office was located in the American sector, the first American specialist arrived as early as June 2, 1945. Now a different wind blew through the venerable old building. Colonel Richard Spencer, who worked at the patent office in Chicago in his civilian life, had all the files reviewed. Colonel Spencer knew how important patent registration files were. He had all the important files photographed. In the first month alone, 30,000 meters of microfilm, so this is 30 kilometers, that is roughly 27 miles of microfilm. Microfilm, you know, there is one image as the size of a nail, 27 miles of microfilm were photographed and transported to the United States. The relentlessly efficient U.S. specialists were able to ship another 3,000 tons of patent material to the USA in the following months. On July 26, 1946, in London, 28 states agreed to grant their own citizens perpetual licenses for all German patents and trademarks. In practice, this meant that German companies were not allowed to sell their own products in these countries if they bore their own trademark and were based on their own inventions. Only the neutral states of Sweden, Switzerland, Spain, and Portugal did not join this collective plunder. But even this had no practical significance because license fees had to be paid continuously for patents and trademarks and no German received any foreign currency from the victors for this purpose. The damage was unimaginable. We will discuss this further later. Until now, it was generally accepted that the victorious powers confiscated 346,000 German patents after the war, including approximately 200,000 foreign patents and 146,000 domestic patents. In addition, there were 20,870 German trademarks and 50,000 new color formulas that E.G. Farben had not yet been able to register with the patent office. However, new research has unearthed three documents from the Office of Technical Service dated April 2, 1947, which indicates that these high figures considered by skeptics to be mere fantasy were actually far too low. These documents concern an inquiry from the firm of Hammill and Gillespie regarding German patents. The American authority wrote, "You will probably be interested to know that individual copies of virtually all German patents issued up to the last day of the war are compiled in a complete set in the Commerce Building. The set of German patents were seized from Berlin, from the Berlin Patent Office, and evacuated to the United States in the spring of 1946. German patent number 750,986 was the last in the series. Photostatic copies of these patents can be ordered from the U.S. Patent Office for 20 cents per page." This was the letter the company Hammill and Gillespie got back from the authorities. This officially proves that not 344,600, but 750,986 patents were stolen from the Berlin Patent Office by the USA. However, this did not include the patents that were not made publicly available. Siemens alone lost 25,000 patents, large quantity of drawings, construction plans to the victors, which weighed even more heavily than the overall damage to the corporation of about 2.58 billion Reichsmarks during the war. The explanation did not end there. Even after the war, England demanded the free surrender of all German patents that had been patented in the post-war years. By surrendering these patents and inventions, the German people have in reality already made a reparation payment such as no other nation in the world has ever raised before. This fact is mostly more or less deliberately overlooked abroad. There was a statement of the first German Chancellor, Konrad Adenauer, in 1947. And we can, without doubt, we can consider that an understatement. Near Bad Kulburg in Thuringen, American special forces seized a treasure of special kind at Heldberg Fortress. It considered 204 cubic meters of film from the Reich Air Ministry. These important documents were transported to the USA in sacks. Just try to get a picture. 204 cubic meters. I have no idea how much cubic yards this are. I don't know. Probably. I don't know. I have to calculate. I didn't calculate it. And these are microfilms. Among them were information about the latest development of Krieghoff Company in Suhl in the field of air armaments and other technical developments that promised the captured forces a years-long technological advantage in the arms industry. This was all the more interesting because these documents were also located in an area that was assigned to the Soviet occupation zone. As I said before, it was very suspicious to many people why General Patton's army suddenly turned the direction and moved down there. This document from the TIID proves that at least 750,986 patents were transferred from the Berlin Patent Office to the United States. The text indicates that there were also more patents that were not publicly accessible. So this is this letter which the company wrote to the Hamel and Gillespie, but the official office wrote to Hamel and Gillespie. Also, no effort was spared and every last corner of occupied Germany was scrutinized. Doubts remain to this day as to whether everything was subsequently found. One report pointing in this direction concerns the incredible extent of microfilming as reported to the Allies by the German prisoner of war, Kurt Creutzfeldt. Creutzfeldt wrote that an agency was founded specifically for microfilming of important technical and political documents under the control of Colonel Sauer in Berlin and had its office at Potsdamer Street 88. The agency came under the control of Speer's Ministry of Armaments, but also occupied all the important documents of the SS main office. After the first heavy attacks on Berlin 1943, it was decided to hide three or more series of copies at various distribution points, probably in the southern Germany. Secret to this day, the files of the Reichspost Research Institute. The Reichspostal Search Institute, RPF, founded on January 1st, 1937, by the Reich Postal Ministry or Minister Dr. Onesorg, was one of the most enigmatic at the time, probably also the most important technology centers of the Third Reich. They dealt with high frequency technology and atomic physics for military and industrial purposes, radar programs, television guided missiles, and tank control, defense against enemy bombers, infrared night vision devices, follower guidance systems, ionospheric research, radiation measurements, eavesdropping technology, and the encryption and decryption of secret codes. It is interesting that the Reichspost Research Institute also worked in areas where, according to the currently widespread official historical narratives, the Allies were decisively superior to the Germans. High-frequency technology, radar, nuclear physics, and espionage. The majority of the files, comprising 750 patent applications, survived the war in the basement of the Deutschlandhaus in Berlin, radio station on the Masurenallee. However, important research files and notes on the agreements with the representatives of the various branches of the Wehrmacht did not survive. They fell into the hands of the Allies at the end of the war, and some are said to be still in the custody of the NSA at Fort Meade, Maryland, as former secret wartime documents. Many of the former RPF scientists continue working on mostly the same topics after 1945, only for different non-German clients. In search of Kammler's 55 treasuries, armed US expedition into Czechoslovakia 1946, the SS General Dr. Hans Kammler had, bypassing the usual industrial, scientific, and military channels, decided to move most critical research organizations under the control of the SS. This mainly to reduce sabotage and treason, thus moving highly sensitive research projects out of the focus of Allied Intelligence Services. Hans Kammler, pictured here, in the summer of 1943, had been one of the leading figures in German rocket programs since the assassination attempt of Hitler in July 1944. By the end of the war, a completely new research, production, and control structure for scientific findings had emerged, bypassing or replacing the normal channels of German research. At the end of its active period, the Kammler Group thus set upon a vast trove of microfilms containing knowledge of the most revolutionary German research secrets. These included, among other things, atomic technologies for propelling aircrafts, guided missiles, cyclotrons, and laser projects. Hans Kammler's secrecy was so successful that the Allies, or technocrats, had absolutely no idea about Kammler's group when they invaded Germany in the spring of 1945. The 55-year-old general was known to them until then only as an important man in the rocket armament. As the general told his wife, the Americans had already made him an offer to build a rocket industry in the United States. Apparently, Kammler died at the end of the war, another supposition that was never confirmed. When finally, in July 1945, it was learned from the head of the Reich's Research Council, Professor Dr. Ossenberg, that there was another parallel think tank, SS General Dr. Kammler had bypassing the industrial scientific military channels, created his own organization, the Kammler Group. Its function can be best compared to the modern day think tank. It was located at the Skoda Works in Prague. So that was one of the reasons why the American intelligence had no idea how far the Germans were actually developed in atomic weapons research. And I mean, there's all kind of indication today which suggest that Germany was in possession of plutonium bombs, or let's say weapons, as low in weight as 15 kilograms. So roughly 7.5-8 pounds, that they had already developed the way to fit a nuclear head on one of the latest rockets, the A9, and there are rumors that one of those A9 were actually ready to be started to hit London, to eliminate London, practically wipe it off, but it has not been started. All of that was not in the normal known circle of the nuclear research people, which were very prominent, like Heisenberg, and these, which were always watched by the American and the Allies' intelligence, and so everybody knew what they were trying with the heavy water things and all of that. But this group under the SS General Dr. Kammler was absolutely unknown. The foolish behavior of the commanding U.S. officers had previously led to a handover of crucial files on German rocket research to the Russians during the transfer of the Skoda Works from the U.S. Army to the Soviets. At least two intelligence missions were subsequently sent to Skoda, but despite the cooperation of German and Czech Skoda employees, they were unable to obtain more detailed information due to the close surveillance by Eastern intelligence agents. So they tried to correct that, said some additional missions over there. Hey, can you tell us something? But these people who knew about it were too closely watched by the Russian and who knows other intelligence organizations. The relevant intelligence information about this period is to this day largely redacted. However, researcher Henry Stevens is several times, he is sized in that book with his research results, discovered on a legible page of the relevant U.S. document, government microfilm, that it suggested an investigation into 2.5 million Skoda documents on microfilm in three caves immediately east of Sripska, whatever, that's the street, I guess, in case the Americans were not satisfied with the completeness of the investigations conducted so far. Representatives of the Allied intelligence services had already targeted the Junkers works in Dessau during the war. I think I told you when I was in Dessau for a year, I got told that the Junkers Werke had separated their manufacturing in several different places. So when the bombers came and hit one place, they couldn't destroy the whole manufacturing. And one of those incendiary bombs actually destroyed that little church where I went for Sunday school on Wednesdays, if you remember. So during the Third Reich, the Junkers Works had grown into one of the most important German armaments companies. Intensive work was carried out there on the development of aircraft and the most modern engines. Shortly after Germany's surrender, a group of American aviation experts were flown into Dessau, which had been captured shortly before, including the prominent transatlantic aviator Charles Lindbergh. Now, again, I have to remind you, Dessau was part of the Soviet occupation zone, right? But you remember also that American armed forces met the Soviet armed forces at the Elbe River at a town which is named Torgau. I think the famous scene in the Patton film shows that where the American officers should toast to Stalin and he refused. Maybe you remember, I don't know if you have seen that movie. So the United States Armed Forces went up to that area on the Elbe River and captured also, that includes Dessau. The Allies had immense respect for the former German Luftwaffe, and one of their demands for the post-war period was therefore that Germany should never again be able to build its own air force. Although the Junkers factories were located in an area designated for handover to the Russian troops, all books in the Junkers library, even rare pre-war literature, were quickly and completely removed and taken to the USA. The seizure operation affected not only the Junkers company, but also other institutions that had played a significant role in history of the German Luftwaffe, such as the Focke Wulf Company, the German Academy of Aeronautical Research, and the German Research Institute for Gliding, the Aviation Radio Research Institute, and of course, the Reich Air Ministry itself. In the USA, the books and journals removed on behalf of the Air Force were handed over to the Library of Congress at the Wright Field in Dayton, Wright Airfield Dayton. According to Richard Eales, or Eales, however you pronounce that name, the leading head of the aeronautic division, the first shipment from Wright Airfield comprised 9,114 aviation books, journals, and articles, an additional 18,000 items from various Air Force literature fields were also handed over to the Library of Congress. This brought the total number of individual publications from German aeronautical research transferred to the Library of Congress to 27,000. It looks very much like some of those of the books taken away from Germany have already disappeared into dark channels, because Charles Lindbergh alone is said to have taken 17,000 volumes from the Yonkers Library to the U.S. Now, Charles Lindbergh, we all know, however, was devout to aviation and its development throughout his life, and certainly did not want to contribute to the disappearance of historically unique collections of books of the highest scientific and cultural historical significance. And that is precisely what happens. An inspection in recent years revealed that after examining two-thirds of the aviation collection in the American Library of Congress, only about a dozen volumes containing inscriptions from German aviation institutions remain. The remaining approximately 26,000 books, journals, and articles are still considered lost in the United States. Individual items have since resurfaced. So yeah, probably somebody sold them for good. An astronomical amount of loot was taken from Germany. To this day, it is not known whether an exact count was ever carried out of how many documents were taken from Germany. Some of these documents consisted of more than 1,000 pages. Others, such as patent applications, contained only one sheet. The American aerodynamicist von Karman mentioned approximately 3 million documents weighing 1,500 tons were reviewed and microfilmed in Europe. They merely formed the basis of the Armed Service Technical Information Agency, from which the Defense Technical Information Center later emerged. If one adds to this the 1,554 tons of classified documents that the Americans brought to the U.S. Aeronautical Research Facility on Wright Field, Ohio, and the approximately 6,000 tons of files that, according to statements in the New York Times, were processed by leading officials such as John C. Green at the Office of Technical Services, OTS, then the number of stolen pages reach astronomical proportions. Even in 1957, it had not yet been possible to process all the findings, and the unprocessed intellectual reparations from Germany filled large green boxes that were piled up to the ceiling in the halls of Congress Library. One day, it had all disappeared, without anyone ever learning what ultimately happened to the content of these boxes. Just disappeared. The USA was able to secure the lion's share of the living knowledge. This is irrefutable, established today. Immediately after the end of the war, the Americans initiated the scientific import program Overcast, which was officially adopted in July 1945. In March 1946, it became the Operation Paperclip. These foreign deployments, as they called that, were not always on a purely voluntary basis. I have to, just on a side note, I have to tell you, while preparing that presentation and walking to the books, there were times where I was at a point where I said, no, I can't. And just reading this makes me so sick, I was about to throw up. And when you look at Germany today, after they have rubbled themselves out of the rubble of the terror bombings, destroying over 6,000 cities and towns in Germany during the war, bombing women, children, and elderly people into oblivion, they rubbled themselves out of it. In installed a new high technology, highly advanced engineering system and industries, which were highly appreciated worldwide. Now again, it is brought down to its knees with foreign influence. And we all know who's behind that. Yeah, there were minutes where I was so sick, I was almost throwing up. It is enormous what the German people and the German nation had to endure. Not only in World War I, but then in the 20s and up to the 33, and then from 39 on again. So these foreign deployments, as they called it, were not always on a purely voluntary basis. When German scientists and engineers were deemed important enough, they were abducted and forcibly relocated, not only by Russians. So that myth is widely spread. People who don't know about Operation Paperclip don't understand that the relocation, the forcefully relocation of German engineers and scientists did not only happen to Russia or Soviet Union, if you take it. The so-called democratic powers in the United States and England behaved no differently. The victorious powers considered the Germans their legitimate human spoils. By taking the German scientists, the Allies violated their own laws. Let's have a look at some of these successful discoveries. As if to learn a new language. The scientific discoveries and the inventions the German engineers and scientists had done during those years from 1930 to 1945 were on such a level that it was far beyond the technical knowledge of the United States engineers and scientists. The technological knowledge brought back from Germany proved to be so novel that its practical application posed massive problems, especially for commercial users. As a remedy, a new German-English technical dictionary was created. By October 1946, it had become apparent that there were no English equivalents for 40,000 German scientific and technical terms. 40,000. These terms had arisen from entirely new insights that the Victors did not yet possess. However, by the time the processing of the German documents was completed, the dictionary had grown to an astounding number of approximately 100,000 new words. Just a brief summary of listed in two articles. One is the New Chronicle by Ian Bevan in the UK, and the other one is an American magazine by Lester Walker. Both journalists were very famous and very well known at the time of the war, reporting about the technology, the invention, for example, the improvement of the P-51 by putting the British engine from the Spitfire into the P-51 to get that plane to the specifics, which then made it able to compete with the Focke-Wulf 190. So these people were very well known in the military area, in military production and things like that. So Ian Bevan writes in his article, and that's a cut of his, just a part. Among the seized secrets were, for example, inventions and instructions for the production of synthetic fuel, synthetic rubber, synthetic lubricating oil, for the production of synthetic fibers and textiles, diesel engines, optics, heavy printing presses, wind tunnels, which speeds up to over 8,000 kilometers per hour. So we're talking about 7,000 something miles per hour wind tunnel speed were achieved. Infrared targeting devices, cassette recorders, electrical capacitors, long-life fruit juice, machines for wrapping chocolate, synthetic sapphires for watches, synthetic mica or mica, run resistant and walk resistant ladies' stockings. Huh? Who invented them? Oh no, weren't the Germans, were the Americans, right? Yeah, sure. Butter churns that produced 1,500 pounds of butter per hour, quartz watches. Oh, who invented those? Timex, right? Yeah. Insecticides, colloids as rust preventives, paints, and a substitute for zinc chromium. Artificial leather, plastics, color photography, a vast number of precision instruments, and thousands of other discoveries in chemical, physical, and technological fields, and electronic fields in which, according to leading specialists, the Germans were ahead of all other nations by classes, by 5, 10, or even several more years in development. Lester Walker, who read an article for the American magazine, and I think it was in early 1946, he had the head of the communications for the 2UE, for ILM, I forgot to put that in. That is a American military committee which was responsible, the 2UE, responsible for analyzing the German papers brought over for the use of military applications that were these guys. And this guy was the head of communications, and he had invited Walker to talk about all the stuff that they had discovered. And he opened his desk, and after asking, would you like to see some special items from the wartime secret collection, and took out his drawer, the smallest vacuum tube Walker had ever seen. It was only about the half size of a thumb, and that was amazing. A vacuum tube that size. Note, it is made of a heavy porcelain, no glass, and it's virtually indestructible. It's sufficient for 1,000 watts, one-tenth of the size of a run-the-mill American tube. Today, our manufacturers know how the secrets of how to do this. They know how to do, they knew how to do that at the time, but they couldn't repeat the process. I will come to that later. It must be noted here that the author may have made an error, forgivable, given the technical understanding of the time. Why would one enclose a small electronic device that had to regulate 1,000 watts, which is 1 kilowatt, in a heat-insulating ceramic casing? You wouldn't do that. It would glue up, right? You can't do that. So Mr. Walker was shown a solid-state diode, maybe a transistor. That was what this guy had in his hand, didn't even know what it is. Next, the journalist saw a German magnetic tape which was made of plastic and coated on one side with a metallic iron oxide. The Germans had used it to replace phonographic records. An entire day's radio program could be recorded on one single reel. It could be demagnetized and reused as often and for as long as desired. No needle, absolutely no noise or wear. Thus, the tape recorder was also a German invention. He was also shown infrared devices that the Germans had developed to the point of being operational in tanks and other vehicles, and to the point of successfully integrating them into precision rifles. For the infrared telescope, the Germans had developed a miniature generator 5 inches in size, powered by a flashlight battery. It rotated at 10,000 RPM, and required the development of a novel lubricant. Why is that so interesting? I will tell you later. Lubricant grease made from chlorinated paraffin. The generator lasted for 3,000 hours of operation. 5 inches in size. Run at 10,000 RPM and lasted for 3,000 hours. And with that, they needed that to get the high voltage they needed for the infrared light tube to send out infrared light to light up the target area when the infrared receiving part could picture that image in the scope so that the soldier could hit his target. The Americans had also discovered novel capacitors made of paper and coated with a layer of vaporized zinc. A 1/52,000th of an inch thick, 40% smaller and 20% cheaper than the American capacitors. They were also self-healing. This meant that if damage occurred, the zinc film vaporized, the paper immediately sealed, and the capacitor functioned again. They could withstand multiple failures, and their performance was 50% higher than that of the American capacitors. The zinc layer was 0.1 micrometers, or a thousandth of a millimeter. Such a thickness is achieved today using PVD, physical vapor deposition, or CVD, chemical vapor deposition, methods. But the PVD method was only used in the 1960s, and the CVD method was only officially developed by the Californian company Janus in 1986. Who invented CVD and PVD? Oh, company Janus. Okay, I know. It looks very much like a reinvention of the German process that the Robert Bosch company had already successfully used for its paper capacitors in the 1940s. Walker had already seen and reported on the corresponding products in 1946. Then he was informed about the secrets of German silicon production, the basic material for transistors and today's microtechnology. Here too, the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute achieved a scientific breakthrough in the production of natural 100% secure, pure silicon. Then came the German secret in the aerospace sector. The V2 rockets were merely toys compared to what the Germans still had planned. Lieutenant Colonel John A. Keck used precisely the same words in his communication of June 28, 1945. Certainly, the V1, V2, V1, V2, they bombarded London with these things, right? The rockets which blast over, they were uncontrolled, they were just programmed to run a certain way. Or the ME-262 were astonishing high-tech products for the British and Americans at that time, but compared to the Singer bomber, the A-9, A-10 rockets, or the flying saucers, they were just indeed toys. The Germans had 138 types of guided missiles in various stages of production and development, and used every possible known method of guidance and ignition, such as radar, radio, wire, continuous radio waves, acoustics, infrared, light beams, magnetic methods, to name only a few. For propulsion, they employed all methods of jet propulsion offered for subsonic and supersonic speeds. Walker used the term light beam when describing rocket guidance methods, which can only be translated as light ray, which in itself makes no sense. However, if one considers that laser beams are special light rays, then the situation is different. The laser beam can indeed guide a rocket to its targets. This was actually used by the United States. We probably have here future evidence of the existence of laser technology in Germany at that time. Walker also spoke about other rockets. The A9, it had a range of 3,000 miles and was manufactured in Peenemünde. It could reach incredible speed. The words Walker used here clearly convey that the impression that the rocket already existed and functioned.